In this first hour of the program, we will be talking about how it is that in this country we have responded to terrorism and some of the concerns raised by people who are interested in civil liberties, and also perhaps in the relative powers of the presidency and the Congress. I also think that we'll spend some of our time this morning, though, talking about the Middle East. And we're fortunate that the guest we have this morning has thought about and written about both these subjects and others as well. Our guest is Mark Perry. He is an author, a journalist, and also foreign policy analyst. He has written articles for many magazines and papers, just to name a couple, The Nation, Washington Post, LA Times, Christian Science Monitor. He's also authored 5 books. And maybe I'll just mention one in particular because it bears on what's going on right now, and that is A Fire in Zion, The Israeli-Palestinian Search for Peace. That book was published by William Morrow and came out in 1994. And when the book came out, we talked about it here on this program. Our guest has also served as editor and Washington bureau chief for a number of publications. He was editor and publisher of Washington, D.C.'s City Paper. He was editor of The Veteran. He served as a special correspondent for The Nation and was editor of Middle East Insight. Right at the moment, he's director of War and Peace Studies for Vietnam Veterans of America Foundation, which is a humanitarian organization. In that position, he helped coordinate the work of the International Campaign to Ban Landmines, which they founded and also which won the Nobel Prize for Peace in 1997. He's been good enough to spend some time with us on the phone this morning. And, of course, as we talk, questions are welcome. All we ask of callers is they just try to be brief so we can get in as many different people as possible. But anyone's welcome to call 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers to call. Mr. Perry, hello.
David, good to be back with you.
Well, we appreciate you giving us your time. And I know that there are many demands on your time today, so I'm really glad that we could talk. And I assume that you wouldn't mind, given the circumstances, that we said, in addition to this subject we said we would talk about, I would be remiss if I didn't take advantage of the fact that you've written about the Middle East to talk a little bit about that, too.
Well, I appreciate that, and I welcome the opportunity.
Well, let's start with the war on terrorism and civil liberties.
Yes.
As people will recall, about 2 weeks ago, President Bush signed an order, interestingly enough, not in his capacity as president, but in his capacity as commander-in-chief of the military, an order paving the way for military tribunals to try people accused of being involved in the terrorist attacks in September. There are a number of people who have raised questions. Both liberals and conservatives have raised questions about it. Some members of Congress have raised questions about it. Civil libertarians, people who are concerned about the balance of power. It's caused quite a lot of discussion. And in fact, this week, Mr. Ashcroft will be testifying, I believe, in the Senate.
Yes.
Some members of the Senate have said they're kind of concerned about this as well. On top of all this, then we'll layer opinion polls that tell us the American people, they don't seem to be concerned about the civil liberties issues at all, at least as long as we're talking about individuals who are not American citizens. So what are we to make of all of this?
Well, I think that I'm very aware of the opinion polls, and I understand the administration's position. I am concerned, however, that this is a slippery slope, that we're starting a process here that is secret, that's going to happen behind closed doors, that's going to include classified information, that's not going to be a unanimous vote of any tribunal, that's going to be three-quarters or two-thirds, that that the net that Mr. Ashcroft has put out there is too wide, that this could turn into a witch hunt. It wouldn't be the first time that this has. I think that we need to be a little bit more careful if we circumscribe our liberties in the name of security. I think we're going to lose our liberties, and once lost, they're going to be very hard to return. So I'm a little circumspect. I am against the tribunals. I think our court system is perfectly capable, in an open setting, of putting these people on trial.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know that people have pointed to the fact that it was successfully accomplished in the trials of those people accused in connection with the first attempt on the World Trade Center, and they say, well, that seemed to work pretty well there. Why should it not work in this case?
Well, that's very true. I think that's right. And we've had some experience with military tribunals. I'm at pains to point out that In 1865, Abraham Lincoln's assassination called for a military tribunal, and an innocent person was hung as a result of being found to be part of a conspiracy that he was not part of, and part of the John Wilkes Booth clan. We don't want that to happen again. We don't want to go out and just put people on trial and get the wrong people. We want to get the right people. And I have, believe me, I'm not here defending in any measure those who would attack my country. But I think that we need to show the world by example that we're different than the terrorists. We have freedoms. We're going to guard them.
The other day, one of my colleagues was talking up with the president of the American Civil Liberties Union, and this subject came up. And she and also some of the callers that were involved in the conversation made the observation that they felt that perhaps some of the people, perhaps a lot of the people who in surveys responded to the question by saying that they thought this was okay, they didn't have any problem with this, didn't really have a very good understanding of the shape and the form of these military tribunals. That is, they weren't aware that there are different rules of evidence, that suspects don't get to choose their representative, that person is appointed, and that person is a military officer, and the judges are military officers, and it doesn't require unanimous assent of the judges for conviction. Okay. You know, and the proceedings may be almost everything except the outcome may be secret. You know, all of these sorts of things. I think the suggestion was that perhaps people who are saying, "Oh gosh, I don't have any problem with that," don't really understand how these tribunals would operate.
I think that's right, and I think that's a very good observation. Most people, when they think of a military tribunal, I'm certainly not accusing the American people of ignorance, but we do need to inform them of what this means. This is not a replay of a scene from A Few Good Men where anyone can come into the courtroom. This is not the Caine Mutiny court-martial. This is a secret proceeding with secret evidence. Given to appointed judges and appointed defense counsel and appointed prosecutor. It comes close to a drum court. It's done in very extraordinary circumstances. I've heard the argument, well, these are extraordinary circumstances. I certainly understand people's fear about something like September 11th and that it might continue and that we need to take action. I think we are taking action in Afghanistan. That's the kind of action we should take. But you have to understand that even for the most heinous crimes, that is, for those in World War II, the Nuremberg trials were open. The evidence was open. The defense had rights. And there were people acquitted at Nuremberg, but the most guilty were given just sentences and were executed. I don't see why in a case like Nuremberg we can have an open trial, but in this case, which is certainly not as extraordinary, we have to have closed trials.
Mm. Our guest, again, in this part of Focus 580 is Mark Perry. He is a journalist and author, and we're talking this morning in the initial part of the program about some of the issues raised by how we have responded in this country to the problem of terrorism, particularly the decision by Mr. Bush to pave the way for military tribunals to try those people accused in the terrorist attacks in September. We have already a couple of callers lined up and ready to go, and we certainly are interested in the thoughts of the people who are listening. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois, Indiana, north, south, wherever the signal will travel, even over the internet. And that's 800-222-9455. The first caller is in Champaign and line 4. Hello?
Hi.
Yes.
I have a question about something that I heard in the media, and maybe you could clarify. You brought up the First World Trade Center trial, and I read a number of reports that said that in the First World Trade Center evidence, there was evidence of given that had to do with how we traced Osama bin Laden in terms of his satellite calls, and that after that, once that evidence came out, he stopped using those satellite calling system. Do you know anything about that, or is that accurate? And is that a reason to, evaluate openness or closeness of evidence?
It's a very good question. In fact, I think the report is true. From what I've heard, it is accurate. That evidence given in that trial did tip off Osama bin Laden to increase his security. I hasten to add, however, that his ability to do that, which resulted from that trial, did not impinge our ability to intercept his other communications one bit. And I don't think we can attribute the September 11th attack to any lack of security as a result of that trial in 1993. There are concerns that evidence presented in an open courtroom can be used by terrorists to shift their or alternate their tactics. But the concern is rather marginal, and it hasn't proven to really inhibit any of our intelligence functions.
Thank you.
All right, thanks. And of course, the same kind of point has been raised when people question the holding of witnesses without any public notification of who these people are. This is the same justification as well, that somehow that knowing that, making that information public would benefit the people that we're fighting against.
Yeah, the evidence is that that's shown not to be true, that anything that happens in open court really hasn't inhibited our intelligence functions whatsoever. And I think, you know, we need to take that into consideration. And even in open court, a judge can call a conference in his chambers to determine the sensitivity of classified information, and that information can be provided in camera if necessary. So it's not as if everything is open, even in an open court. It's possible to guard secrets at the same time that you give defendants a fair and open trial. Hmm.
Another caller here. This is Urbana, and it's line number one. Hello.
Hi. There seems to be a theme here, at least to me, and that is a total evasion of the constitutional bedrock of separation of powers. Hmm. In the area you're discussing, the president is, as commander-in-chief, has not consulted Congress, has shown little regard for the process of the courts, and rule of law, which I keep hearing from Republicans, is being demolished. But there's another area I want to get your response to that fits under this same umbrella of the and there is an extra judicial group, extra governmental group called the Defense Policy Board, which has an office right beside Mr. Rumsfeld, and without any consultation with the Congress of the United States, without any declaration of war, is now putting up a building pressure to move against Iraq in the way we bomb them and create a new front with the so-called anti-Saddam dissidents and create a new army and take care of the Iraq problem. Now, I wish you'd discuss the implications of that along the lines that you've been talking about. How dangerous is this? And it's not being well reported at all.
Well, the caller is very well informed. In fact, this week, Senator Leahy of the Judiciary Committee is calling the Attorney General John Ashcroft to testify, and I think it's going to be a rough session. I think that there's real sensitivity, not just on the part of Democrats, but even on the part of many civil libertarian Republicans, to question whether it is within the purview of the executive branch to set up military tribunals without consulting with the Congress. This has really stepped over the line. And it's constitutional. There's no question constitutionally it's up to the Congress to do that. Let me just grab the second issue. There is a group inside the Pentagon that is pushing the Secretary of State, the Vice President, and the President to expand the war on terrorism to target Iraq and other nations, including Syria and Iran. The leader of this faction and the one who's been the most outspoken in administration circles has been the Deputy Secretary, Assistant Secretary of Defense, Paul Wolfowitz. But so far, I think that Secretary Powell has been successful in focusing the war on Afghanistan and leaving those other questions for later. Obviously, when we go after Iraq, there are going to be, and I think we will eventually target Iraq, there are going to be very grave concerns on the part of moderate Arab states that could really undermine the kind of coalition we're building. And that is, it might not be well reported where you are, but this debate inside the federal government, inside the executive branch, is very well known here in Washington. It's very serious, and it goes on every single day in the editorial pages across the country.
Does that get at your question, caller?
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Other questions, comments are certainly welcome. Again, the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Good. Anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Perhaps I also will mention that National Public Radio has told us that they're going to provide coverage of these hearings in the Senate on Thursday. And assuming that nothing else changes, that NPR doesn't change their mind, that the hearings take place when scheduled, we're planning on offering live coverage. So people will have the opportunity to hear this in full. And as I said, I believe that last time I saw that it was supposed to start Thursday at 9 o'clock our time. So people can look for that.
Should be fascinating.
I'm interested, again, going back, we talked a little bit about the fact that there seems to be significant public support for what Mr. Bush has done, for the idea of military tribunals and the other things that we've done, and that in part perhaps that support might be due to people's not being certain just what a military tribunal is all about. I also wonder, though, whether perhaps it reflects some lack of concern on people's parts for the rights of people who are not American citizens. The way that these questions, I think, have been set up, it seems that at least in some cases, we're making it clear that what we're talking about here is not American citizens, and that in that case, people are saying, well, you know, are they being more casual about the idea of civil liberties for people who are not Americans?
I have a two-part answer. The way that I understand that this is set up, the military tribunals have been established simply to focus on the members of the Al-Qaeda network and those who were responsible for September 11th. But the way that the executive order is written is quite extraordinary, and it even mentions that it's possible for the executive branch to detain, question, and it goes a little bit further even than that, those who disagree with American foreign policy. Well, that includes me in some cases, and I'm sure it includes many Americans in some cases. It doesn't mean we're not loyal Americans. It means that we're typical Americans. We question our government openly. And this chilling effect, this could have a chilling effect on civil liberties. I don't think it has so far, but there are some instances where I was hearing on NPR this morning, for instance, that professors are being called to task for, on both sides of this issue on terrorism, for saying things that some people think that they shouldn't say, and we don't want to start down that road. We don't want to have a chilling effect on civil liberties at a time of crisis like this. We need as many voices as possible in our national conversation. And my fear is that while the administration may say that the tribunals are set up for a specific purpose, the executive order establishing them is actually very, very wide and casts a wide net.
We have other callers, but we have two, both in Champaign. First is line number one. Hello.
Hi, thank you. You're a very brave individual, and I am sure, I hope our audience treats you well, but I'm sure you've kind of endured a hailstorm here. I have just a comment and then a question. I think when people get scared by what's happening, they want very quick solutions, and I think in some ways my comment is that this military tribunal is to cover the pitiful, poor, and desperate state of our intelligence network. And I would like to remind people that we gave J. Edgar Hoover, the leader of the FBI, huge powers, and he abused them totally. This is not, civil liberties are not about, is this a just cause? It's about, are human beings, and how do they carry out justice? And I think anyone who has been in the military or had friends in the military knows that court-martials are out of balance. And I'm going to get in a lot of trouble for saying that, but it's true. I've had friends who were tried by a court-martial for not checking to make sure that an engine was mounted to the vehicle. Okay, and that's what happens in court-martials. The people in power cover their own trails, and we need to remember that. But my question is, they're saying these are the same tribunals that our soldiers would be tried by in the field, and I disagree with that. I don't think, can they use secret evidence? Would these, if an American soldier happens to, say, do something he shouldn't and commits a war crime, either shooting innocent civilians who are obviously in a position of surrender, are they going to be tried by these military tribunals? Because that's a big point that's going around, that this is the same justice our soldiers get, and I certainly I don't think that's true. So that's my question. And if you could talk about the difference between a tribunal and a court-martial and maybe a little bit about, you know, the secret courts involved in, you know, Europe and why we got away from secret courts, that'd be great. So thank you.
Okay.
It's a good question. Donald Rumsfeld yesterday called these special military tribunals, not military tribunals, and they're not the same as court-martial. Secretary Rumsfeld on national television yesterday said that he has a lot of smart people working with him. I think he means lawyers who are working on the rules of evidence. So it's not a given that these are court-martial-like tribunals at all. These are special military tribunals set up for the specific purpose of establishing the guilt of innocence of those people involved in the network that bombed the September that did the September 11th attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. So they are quite different, but it's not clear, and I think we'll hear on Thursday during the testimony of John Ashcroft just exactly what kind of rules of evidence they will have and what kind of latitude they will have. It's not clear. I would like to observe, and I think the caller made a good point. At the outset of the Cold War, when the country felt in grave danger, 48 to 55, we did have in this country a witch hunt, the McCarthy era, in which people believed that we had to take extraordinary steps to protect ourselves. And one of those extraordinary steps was to investigate whether people had ever been members of the Communist Party or affiliated with the Communist Party or members of parties that were affiliated with it, and it ruined a lot of lives, and it was way out of bounds. I think we're in the same period of time now where the fear that we are under imminent attack is pervasive, where people feel very vulnerable. I was just in New York for 2 days last week, and the security in the office buildings is extraordinary, and you can certainly understand why. But it lends itself to this kind of fear, and that's the environment in which we are now living. And it seems to me, in light of our experiences during the Cold War, the early parts of the Cold War, we have to be extraordinarily careful that we don't let this situation get out of hand. And I think that the questioning on Thursday has to be very tough on this particular point.
We are almost at our midpoint here. I have other callers. Perhaps I should just take a minute to introduce again our guest. We're talking with Mark Perry. He's an author, journalist, foreign policy analyst. He has written articles for many magazines and newspapers. He's the author of 5 books, among them one dealing with the Arab-Israeli-Arab-Palestinian conflict that from 1994, titled A Fire in Zion, The Israeli-Palestinian Search for Peace. He has also written Eclipse, The Last Days of the CIA, and his first book looking at the 40-year battle between the Joint Chiefs of Staff and America's civilian leaders, that book titled 4 Stars. At the moment, he is director of War and Peace Studies for Vietnam Veterans of America Foundation. It's a humanitarian organization, and in that position, among other things, he helped coordinate the work of the international campaign to ban landmines. He's also worked for other publications. He has served as correspondent for The Nation. He was also editor of Middle East Insight. And we're talking here this morning. We started out talking about some of the civil liberty concerns raised by the response to the war on terrorism. And also we can try to talk a little bit about the Middle East as well before we find ourselves out of time. Questions and comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Another champagne caller here, line number 2. Hello.
Yes, hello. Earlier you were talking about the polls and how it appears that the American people are backing or at least showing ambivalence toward the tribunals and the erosion, potential erosion of civil liberties. And my observation there is that over the last 2 months, we've been bombarded by war speak and jingoism and this feeling of grave danger that you talked about in World War II has been impregnated on the populace. And so I think that's what's going on. There's been a tremendous campaign by the government, and I'm on the left of things normally, and so I hate to sound like a Republican, but with a certain conspiratorial acquiescence from the media to whip the public into a frenzy where they do perceive a danger far greater than exists.
Well, I guess my response to that is might be a little bit different. I sense too that there is an overwhelming flow of patriotism coming out of the American people in the media, but I think that that's natural. I don't think it's planned. I think that the events of September 11th were so extraordinary that people are just stunned by it. It's going to take the country a long time to get over it. I will say, I'm a conservative. I'm a Republican, and but I'm a little bit more on the civil libertarian part of it. I think that I agree with the caller in one sense. I think that our institutions are very strong, and I think that our leadership is very strong, and I think the collective will of the American people is very strong, and I think that we'll come out of this tunnel. And I've been actually buoyed by people calling in, as on this program, who are just as disturbed as I am about their civil liberties being infringed, but who are also very concerned that we protect our country. So the conversation that we're having in the country is good, and it's been very useful, and I think that it's actually made us stronger.
Okay, I have one other question. First, one other observation. I see no difference between the word patriotism and the word jingoism, but beyond that, we got into Vietnam. We got into Vietnam over the course of three presidencies, and then Johnson engineered the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, and that was the legal reason for calling that a war. Not for calling it a war, as a police action, but that was the legal reason to commit so many troops. What is the legal footing for Mr. Bush and Mr. Bush's father before him for fighting a war without having it declared by Congress?
I think it's a slippery question, and I have a slippery answer. Mr. Bush's father actually was very careful and had people around him who made it very clear to him that he ought to get a debate in Congress. It ought to be open, and that he ought to get a sense of Congress before he moved against Iraq, and it was actually a pretty close vote. But he did get that. He got
a sense of Congress? What does that mean?
Well, there was a vote on Iraq on whether the president had the power to deploy troops and engage those troops in combat in Iraq, and he got that. This president hasn't done that. I don't know why, but I think it's a mistake.
So a sense of Congress is the same as a war resolution?
Oh, yeah. There's no question that the older Bush got a war resolution. There was no debate after the Congress, and it was, you recall, it was quite an intense debate. There was no question after the debate that the president had the power and had the permission of Congress to deploy the troops. That is not the case now. I think the Congress has looked the other way and it has turned over to the executive branch in this current situation the right to wage war, but it's been de facto and not de jure, and it ought to be de jure. I think the president ought to go to the Congress, and I think that you bring up a good point. That is the lesson of Vietnam. If you're going to ask the American people to sacrifice, you have to go to their representatives and get a vote, and I wish that the president would do that. And until he does that, I think things like military tribunals, which are set up in times of war, are going to be problematic, going to be debated, and separation of powers is going to be debated. If we had a clear case where the Congress voted to support the deployment of troops, we might not be having this debate now.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Let's continue. We'll take next caller in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. I agree with you on the civil rights issues, but I wonder if you'd approach this from another standpoint, the tactical effectiveness of it. It seems to me that particularly in the Third World, there is an extreme reluctance to believe that bin Laden was in fact responsible for the attack on the World Trade Center, although it seems almost improbable that he wasn't. But at the same time, there's a strong reaction against the violence of the attack on the World Trade Center. And it seems to me that in part this is due to President Bush's reluctance to provide any evidence that bin Laden was in fact responsible. It seems to me that trials, secret trials of people responsible for such acts, will be greeted with a similar unbelief.
This is an excellent point. This is a really excellent point. And you're absolutely right. I mean, there is abroad in the Middle East the view that somehow bin Laden didn't do this and that we're making it up. And that there's a conspiracy to rope him into this. And open evidence, openly provided in an open court, open to the public and to the world community, would help to resolve that problem. In fact, the evidence for his complicity and his ordering of the September 11th attacks is overwhelming. And why the administration has chosen to kind of dribble this out or leave it to the British to do it, who've done most of it, is kind of confusing and puzzling to me. We have nothing to fear by presenting this evidence, and it's hard for me to believe that, considering the incredible intelligence failure of September 11th, that somehow we would be placing what our intelligence agencies actually know in some kind of jeopardy. I think the caller, I think you made a just an excellent point, and a trial or at least the provision of evidence openly would help us a lot. It's clear that what we're doing in the Arab world in particular is not very convincing to them. We need to do more.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. I guess that was, in fact, the justification of the administration for not making this whatever information they have public. Initially, they said, what we're going to do is we're going to lay all of the information out so that the rest of the world will see quite clearly that Osama bin Laden is responsible. And then it seemed very quickly then after that, the administration backed off that position. And they said, well, no, actually, we're not going to be able to do that because we, again, for the same reason that we're not going to release a lot of other kinds of information, we don't want him to know what we know. And the administration just sort of said, you got to take our word for it.
Yeah, I think the administration quite carefully weighed the positive impact of getting the information public and the negative impact of making it too public and erred on the side of being conservative. The problem with that, of course, is that if you travel in the Middle East, and I just returned 2 weeks ago from a trip there, there is a certain skepticism. And people would ask me on the street, are you sure the evidence? I'd say the evidence is overwhelming. Well, let's see it. Well, it's not there. Well, you see, and it becomes our actions in that part of the world become very suspicious. Now, I don't think the American people are suspicious at all. I think they're convinced by what the administration has said. But we're fighting a war not simply of finding and seeking out our enemies and killing them or bringing them to justice. We're fighting a war for the hearts and minds of the people of the Arab world, and it's just as important, perhaps even a more important battle.
We'll continue. We've got somebody here on cell phone. Let's go there. Line two. Hello.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of things I suppose I could say, but I'm going to try to keep myself to 2 points. One is that I'm not actually surprised by the poll support at all, because I think that poll support, well, first of all, you know, it's easy to say all sorts of stuff in polls, and so that doesn't surprise me. If you ask people in polls, a lot of things they'll often give strong support against the First Amendment, for instance. If you make it so they can't quite tell exactly what it is, but the general idea of free speech is free speech, even if you don't like the message, is there. So I am not at all surprised by a lack of concern for military courts, because I don't think that people take rights of the accused especially seriously, particularly, as you said, when they feel threatened and their backs are up. So I don't know if you want to comment on that.
Well, I will. I'm not surprised by the poll support either. And in general, I found the polling to be a little bit overly general and not detailed enough. I mean, historically, when the American people haven't cared about other people's liberties, for instance, in slavery, people weren't concerned about slavery that much until searches and seizures of slaves in the North became dominant. Then then they became aware of slavery because their own liberties were vulnerable. I've just written a new book about this. It hasn't been mentioned, but I will mention. I hope that people will take a look. It's called Lift Up Thy Voice. It's a story of this very process of maintaining and then having liberties undermined, what that engenders in the American people. What it will engender in this case is if there is one miscarriage of justice that is aimed at a everyday American, you or me or anybody else, the American people will become very concerned, and very quickly, I believe, these military tribunals will be ended, because the American people are very sensitive about their own liberties. They might not care about the liberties of those in foreign nations, but they're very concerned about their own, and it would be a misstep on the part and a miscalculation on the part of this administration to make a misstep on that point.
I don't know. Maybe I'm just more pessimistic than you. I'm not sure. I think that the contours are generally right, but I suspect that if a couple Arab immigrants to the United States were pinched in the process and they didn't actually have anything to do with it, I don't know. Maybe I'm just being cynical, but I kind of suspect that wouldn't.
Well, we have very broad detentions going on right now, and people are very concerned about it. And but you could be right. I mean, we don't see a hue and cry about these detentions right now, and maybe we. I don't blame you for your cynicism, but
I don't know. I mean, I'd like to think better than that, but I'm not sure I do.
Yeah.
The other point is that I really think I have to agree with you when you say that we need to make this evidence clear. I've had some discussions at various times with people from other countries, and there is, in some cases, a rightful skepticism about American actions, and in other cases, there's just rampant paranoia. And I think that, for instance, I suspect that, I don't want to speak in ridiculous generalities, but I suspect there's a fair amount of sentiment among Muslims thinking that we want to make war on Muslims because they're Muslims. I don't think that's true. I don't think that, there's probably some people that want to do that, but most people don't really care about that. They just don't want to get bombed again, and they could care less who was actually doing it. Unfortunately, because if you have a lot of, say, the Arab street thinking that the United States and the Western world wants to make war on them because they're Muslims, that's going to engender a whole different set of responses than would be the case if they were able to say, look, we really don't mind you guys, but we really can't stand the fact that these guys keep blowing our buildings up.
Well, let me just respond. I just returned from there, and it's I have not a simple answer, but an observation about the Arab street and what people in the Middle East believe about the United States and what we're doing. It is an odd mix. On the one hand, I think that there is a great deal of admiration for the United States, and there is a sense, even among the common people of Egypt, the Palestinian Authority, Jordan, wherever you want to go, that Osama bin Laden did this, and they know it. And the United States cannot be blamed for going after him and trying to bring him to justice. And I think it was a miscalculation on the part of Osama bin Laden, a terrible miscalculation, that somehow the Arab street would be with him. The Arab street is not with him. Secondly, the first point is true. My second point is that there is a very real tradition of conspiracy theory when it comes to the United States on the Arab street, and that doesn't result from anything we've done. It results from a sense of powerlessness, disenchantment, and alienation with the political environment in which those people live. And when we're done dropping our bombs, and I hope before then, we have to deal with the root causes of terrorism. And that's the only way, through education, through making people understand our way of life and our freedoms, and having them taste those freedoms themselves. It's the only way we can really, in the long term, defeat terrorism and make people understand that, we're not really out to rule the world. Yeah, we want to sell hamburgers, but we're not out to rule the world. And we would just as soon not go through these kinds of wars. And if we are dedicated as a nation to long-term policies that will engage the sense of disenfranchisement, alienation, powerlessness that is so obvious in the Arab world, I think we'll win this war, but it's going to take a while.
We're now coming to the point where we have less than 10 minutes and the lines are full. And again, we'll try to get in as many people as we can in the time before we have to quit. Again, our guest is Mark Perry. He's a journalist, author. He's authored a number of books. And I'm sorry, perhaps I should have mentioned the most recent one. And they're books on very different subjects about the Middle East, about American defense policy, about America and the Civil War. So if you're interested, you might head out to the bookstore and look for some of these things.
Appreciate that.
And we'll just keep going with our callers here. And I think our next person in line is Urbana, and that would be line 3. Hello.
Yeah, I've got a comment and a question. The comment is that you said earlier that the American people are not about to cave in to terrorist attacks and change their way of life. And I just thought it was ironic that... it's funny that Sharon, Ariel Sharon, is not put to the same standard. I mean, why doesn't he realize that the Palestinian people are very unlikely to cave in to the kind of wife-beater tactics or mentality that he's got?
Let me make a comment.
All right,
very good because it's a good point. And I'm not going to unwrap the whole Palestinian-Israeli conflict. We'd be on until next week. But let me just say that the policies that Ariel Sharon is following in his war against terrorism don't seem to be working. And they have in Israel secret military tribunals. And they have in Israel widespread detention. And they have different laws for different people. And they engage in assassination of foreign leaders, Palestinian leaders, and they engage in confiscation of property and the building of settlements. And how's it going? It's not going very well. Israel is now more vulnerable than at any point in its history. And just 5 years ago, when Yitzhak Rabin made a partnership with Yasser Arafat in a war against terrorism, that seemed to work better instead of treating the secular leadership of the Palestinian Authority as an enemy. Now, let me add very quickly. The events of the last 24 hours are not defensible in any sense of the word, but they shouldn't puzzle anyone. There's a clear sense of desperation on both sides that has to be dealt with, and that has to be dealt with very firmly. But making an enemy of a secular leadership that is the only hope for a future peace, I don't think is the way that Israel should act, and I don't think that we should Israelify or adopt the policies that Ariel Sharon has adopted in defending ourselves, because things will get worse and not better.
Well, but I think clearly that's the direction we're going. But anyway, my question is about the tribunals. I haven't heard anybody discuss the notion that out of the detainees, those people have been detained and are being held. Apparently, there's some thought that if they are the ones that are put on into tribunals, that there's a much softer legal footing for that than if we try people caught in Germany or Spain or something like that, in Guam, say, for example. As long as they don't set foot in the United States, supposedly there's some difference there. Could you speak to that if you know anything about it? And I'll hang up. Thanks.
I'm many things, but a lawyer isn't one of them. And I could only give you a vague answer and a principled one. I think it was clearly the intention of the framers of the Constitution that the laws that would apply here to American citizens should apply to everyone. Now, in any engagement of the court system, even with a foreign national, and that the protections that were enjoyed by Americans are, to use a word that the framers used, inalienable. That is to say, they apply to everybody, and they should be applied to anyone, and that somehow there aren't two forms of justice, one for Americans and one for foreigners, even those who have visa violations in the United States. And I think it's very clear that that was the framers' intention. Now, that was reversed by the Supreme Court when they held that it was possible and legal to hold Japanese Americans in detention camps because of a threat to American society. I hope the Supreme Court revisit that decision in this case and overturn it, because it seems to me that the intention of the framers was exactly the reverse.
We'll try to get at least one more caller to Bloomington, line four. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I want to mention two things. I have two things that I speak about. Bush has said that if you are not for us or with us, you are against us. And I'm just wondering how many of those people in those polls that have been talked about are agree with Bush because they don't want the FBI on their backs. And then I have another thing.
Well, that's a good question. I don't know the answer. It's kind of a rhetorical question. I don't think.
No, but I'm just wondering about that. And I also wonder about this. It seems to me that the administration is incrementally, piece by piece, setting up a dictatorship. And do you think that the American people would agree with that in their polling?
I don't think that the American people would agree with the setting up of a dictatorship. I don't think the American...
Well, I think that's what's happening.
Well, I understand, but I don't think that the majority of the American people would agree with you. I will say this. I have been very pleased that over the last 2 weeks since this issue came up, there have been dozens of talk shows just like this one where people have expressed, not just to me, but to many, many others, their concern with their own liberties. And I think so long as that continues, regardless of what the polls say, so long as that conversation about that issue continues, the Bush administration, regardless of whatever its intentions are, we'd all like to think they're good, but regardless of what their intentions are, they're not going to be able to move very quickly, because they will get a real deep response from the American people. And the last thing this administration needs at a time like this is the kind of divisiveness that this debate has caused in this country and the kind of doubts it has caused. And I think we're going to see over the next week or two a backing away from this military tribunal idea. And I think it'll start on Thursday in the Senate before Senator Leahy's Judiciary Committee.
I'm sorry to say we're going to have to stop. My apologies. We have a caller that we can't take. And I'm sorry, Mr. Perry, we really didn't have an opportunity to talk about the Middle East. Perhaps on another day when you're not so busy, we might have you back and we could talk some more.
I really enjoyed this. I'll come back anytime. Thank you.
All right. We appreciate it very much. Our guest, journalist and writer Mark Perry. Again, you can look for his books on a wide range of subjects. They're available in the bookstore, the Middle East and the U.S. History among them.